Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the real story of the Allied liberation of Europe? Many Americans' understanding of the defeat of the Third Reich was shaped by returning military personnel who came home tired but triumphant, proud to have set Europe free and grateful that the struggle was over. Memories of across the Atlantic are quite different. Those liberated remember months of ongoing deprivation as Allied troops dug in to loosen Nazi Germany's stranglehold. Locals were ambivalent about their liberators, who pushed the Germans out but also dropped bombs that often took innocent victims along with military targets. The Allies' advance signaled the end of war, but not of hunger or cold, as troops consumed precious food, fuel, and supplies that dominated populations could scarcely spare. So why hasn't this history been part of our understanding of the war and of our role in it? William I. Hitchcock is working to change that. He is professor of history at Temple University. His new book is called The Bitter Road to Freedom, A New History of the Liberation of Europe. Will, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris.
Reading this book, it becomes entirely clear that the history of World War II is something that fully unites us with Europe and also separates us from it, because we had entirely different experiences, even in the same places.
Well, it's true. I mean, America had a very difficult World War II experience, no question about it. 400,000 Americans gave their lives in the Second World War, and they were rightly lauded as heroes, and we remember them as heroes even to this day. And I think it's right that we should do so, but Europe had a very different experience. It went through 4 years of German occupation, of course, before the Americans really got into the continental part of the war in Europe, and just an unbelievable toll of Europeans who died in the Second World War, both civilians and soldiers. I mean, we tend to forget that in the Second World War, far more civilians died than soldiers, and it's almost a grotesque concept, but it's very true, and that's of course very different from the American experience, where those people who gave their lives were trained soldiers and they had done the right thing. They were trained for combat. In Europe, a very different picture altogether.
Yeah, you write that the keynote of this European story of liberation is violence. And it wasn't simply violence of innocent people sort of getting in the wrong place at the wrong time. There was brutality even on the part of the liberators.
Well, there was brutality on the part of the liberators, but we have to put it into context. I mean, war is a brutal business, and we tend to forget as Americans when we focus just on the grand story of American military behavior. We think of it as inevitably a good thing, a march towards ultimate victory, and therefore we tend, quite rightly perhaps, to think that whatever sacrifices happened along the way were fully justified. But if you turn around the perspective and look at the perspective from a European civilian who might be living, let's say, in the northern part of France in June or July of 1944, and his or her village might be completely wiped out by Allied aircraft in June or July, then along come tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands, and then literally millions of Allied liberators marching through their town, tearing up their fields, wrecking their neighborhoods and their schools and their churches, inadvertently, of course, but nonetheless, those privations were felt very, very deeply, and it was a real personal crisis for many of these individual Europeans that were liberated. So they looked upon liberation as, of course, something they were desperate for. I mean, you can read through the accounts of individual Europeans in whatever country you want to take, whether it was France or Belgium, the Netherlands, Poland, they were desperate to get rid of the Germans. But liberation came in a storm of violence that many individual Europeans didn't understand, they weren't prepared for, they weren't trained to deal with. So it was a human crisis. We could even say a kind of a human catastrophe for them, and that's the ultimate paradox that I try to get at in this book.
Yeah, to the same extent, it seems that Americans assumed that coming in and liberating Europe was going to had fixed everything for them. It would be reasonable to assume that Europeans also thought that at the time that they were liberated, things would be all fixed once again, and that's not what happened. It was just there was so much to go back in and correct.
Oh my goodness! I mean, once the actual fighting was done, I mean, we tend to think of liberate. What do we mean by liberation? We tend to think of it as the defeat of the bad guys. Get rid of the bad guys and everything will be fine. But actually, the deeper you go into the history of the liberation of Europe, and I think this is probably true of liberations elsewhere in whatever time period you want to choose, getting rid of the German enemy was the main task, but it wasn't the only task. And in fact, the war opened up a humanitarian crisis of enormous proportions that Allied armies weren't really ready for. So there were millions of refugees that had to be sorted out. There were millions of people that the Germans had drawn into Germany during the Second World War to work in their factories, to work in their war industries. And these people came from all across Europe. Most of them came from Russia, Poland, but many came from Southern Europe, from Western Europe. At the end of the war, there were 8 to 10 million foreigners living in Germany, working in very difficult conditions, that all had to be sorted out and returned back to their homes. And that was an enormous humanitarian crisis that the armies of liberation weren't really very well prepared to undertake. They got on the stick. They managed, I think, quite astonishingly well, considering how big that humanitarian task was. But these are the kinds of sort of unpredictable elements that war brings. And we tend to think, well, war is about battles. It is. But it has a ripple effect across human communities in whatever part of the world you're fighting. That's what the Americans discovered in 1945.
One of the really surprising things, I think, to a lot of Americans is how much hunger there was even after liberation. You write about Holland, where they had to import food even before the war ever started. That was just a factor of where they lived, and they brought in cattle feed and different things. By the end of the war, they were getting, maybe a couple thousand calories a week maximum, and they were eating things like tulip bulbs and cattle feed just to keep themselves alive.
Oh, the Dutch story is absolutely horrifying and so difficult. Just it's one corner of a continent in crisis, and we don't talk much about it. But there was a strategic decision in the spring of 1945 not to expend a great deal of energy and wealth and treasure by the Allied armies to go bashing into the northwestern corner of Holland, which was still under German occupation. And the Germans were heavily invested there. They were defending their positions. It was very difficult terrain to fight on, very waterlogged with lots of channels and dikes and canals and so forth. And the British, Americans, and Canadian troops that were fighting there said, look, our real goal is to get to Berlin. So we're going to go east, and we're going to try to get across the Rhine, and we'll deal with the Dutch later. As a consequence, the Germans, who were locked in this small chunk of territory with most of the major big cities of Holland behind enemy lines, they cut off food imports into that part of the territory of Holland, and thousands of Dutch people went very, very hungry, and eventually, we think maybe somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 Dutch people died of starvation in the spring of 1945 as a consequence, first, of German policy. They were the ones that kept the food out, and second, because the Americans had to make a very difficult strategic choice, which was the crisis in Holland, bad as it was not as important as getting across the Rhine and into Germany. These are the kinds of horrifying strategic decisions that Allied leaders had to make again and again, and the Dutch people paid a terrible price. They were incredibly grateful for their liberation when it came in May of 1945, but they did wonder, could it have been a different story? Could we have been liberated earlier? Could they have done more to help us in our hour of need? And they never really got a satisfactory answer to that question.
William I. Hitchcock is my guest. His new book is called The Bitter Road to Freedom, A New History of the Liberation of Europe. At this point in our history, we have seen so many photographs of liberated death camp victims that today they feel familiar, even if they're no less disturbing than they ever have been. But these were not familiar images to the Allied troops who went in and found them initially.
Oh, gosh, certainly not familiar. I mean, we're talking about some of the most toughened soldiers ever. These were men in the American Army and in the British Army that had seen fighting in North Africa. They'd seen fighting in Italy. They'd seen fighting in Normandy. They'd seen fighting in the winter campaigns in the Rhineland. It was very, very difficult. They had seen everything on the battlefield, but they'd never seen anything like what they encountered in the concentration camps. And mind you, American and British soldiers liberated a number of concentration camps in the western part of Germany because that's where they arrived first. And these were not really even the extermination camps of the eastern part of the continent. So what they saw were camps that were filled with many political prisoners, resistance activists, as well as Jews, and they were in a state of total calamity and crisis. I mean, it was a stunning, difficult, and kind of unreal, otherworldly scene that greeted some of these Allied liberators, and their behavior, if you read it carefully and you examine the way what they said and what they did, it shows that they were in a state of shock. They really didn't know what to do with these survivors of the Holocaust, which was a word they didn't know yet. They didn't understand what had happened. In many cases, they didn't know that this was the tip of the iceberg of a larger Jewish catastrophe. And they were, in some ways, turned off, in some ways disgusted, in some ways ashamed, but they just didn't quite know how to handle the human crisis that they encountered in these camps.
You quote one woman in the book who I think was a parliamentary official in Britain who went and sort of toured the area very soon after liberation, and she encountered these essentially walking skeletons. She was so shocked by the way they looked that she writes that, to her shame, she forgot for a moment that they were human beings, the same as she was.
Oh, it's an amazing passage, and there are so many, unfortunately, there's so many like them, but at least she had the courage to admit after the fact that the emotions that she was feeling were perhaps some kind of denial mechanism, so that she transformed these survivors, and they were people in who weighed 70 or 80 pounds, wearing tattered clothing, who had really, in some ways, lost their characteristic traits of human beings as these liberators looked at them. And she acknowledged that she didn't know what to make of them. They looked, in her eyes, unhuman. They were still living, but they were skeletons. And the language that these people used to describe these survivors was, you know, skeletons or apes or mummies or rabbits. There was a constant effort to search for an appropriate vocabulary that they didn't yet possess. And the consequence was they tended to diminish their very humanity at a time when they needed the human touch more than ever. And watching these humanitarian relief workers as well as soldiers dealing with survivors in the first weeks, right after the camps had opened, and observing how difficult it was for them to build a relationship is something that I think we've lost sight of. We tend to think that there was a moment of embrace, and in fact what there was a moment of division and even repulsion.
The other thing that we sort of forget is the idea that these people were so worn down by what they'd experienced that they didn't fully grasp what liberation might mean. You write, and this is a quote, "Liberation brought no clarity, no sense of immediate relief." Their lives were still entirely in chaos.
Well, the story of Jewish survivors, and there were many survivors of the Second World War who were in crisis at the end of the war, but the story of Jewish survivors is an absolutely, to my mind, it's a shocking one. We know that there were about 50,000 Jewish survivors of the Holocaust at the end of the war, still living in Germany, and that number began to rise to about 150,000 as many people came in from Eastern Europe to get away from Poland, to get away from the Red Army, and they came into occupied Germany right at the end of the war. Now, this was occupied by the Americans, by the British, of course, also the French and the Russians, but they came into the American zone of occupation because they felt that they would get some degree of protection from the American soldiers, and they did. But Jewish survivors had nowhere to go. They couldn't go back to their homes and villages in Eastern Europe because many of them had been completely obliterated by the Germans. They didn't want to go back to now communist Poland or into the Soviet Union. They wanted to go to Palestine. Palestine was still controlled by the British at the tail end of the Second World War, and the British refused to allow Jewish immigration. So we have tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands of Jewish survivors of the Holocaust living in camps, in barracks, behind barbed wire, in occupied Germany, not just for weeks after the end of the war, not just for months, but in fact for about 4 to 5 years after the end of the Second World War.
William I. Hitchcock is with us. He's professor of history at Temple University. We're talking about his new book, The Bitter Road to Freedom, A New History of the Liberation of Europe. You can join our conversation by getting on the line now. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is William I. Hitchcock. He's professor of history at Temple University. His new book is called The Bitter Road to Freedom, A New History of the Liberation of Europe. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Will, you have 250,000 Jewish survivors of the camps who are placed once again in camps. 13,000 of them die in the weeks after liberation.
Oh, my goodness. And that was just at Belsen alone. I mean, Belsen was the horrible political and concentration camp in the western part of Germany. And the British soldiers liberated the camp at Belsen, Bergen-Belsen. And they immediately swept in, this is late April 1945, very, very quickly. They moved very quickly into this concentration camp. And there were 60,000 people in Bergen-Belsen, and they were there in such large numbers because they had been moved by the Germans out of the eastern part of the country at the end of the war. So there was it was a kind of a concentration point. There were 60,000 people in Belsen, completely unfed, unwashed. They'd been living there for weeks and for months at the very end of the war without any equipment or sanitation or public health of any kind whatsoever, and it was a scene of absolute and total chaos. The British soldiers just couldn't believe what they saw, and about 13,000 people died within a few weeks because they simply were already too far degraded. Their bodies could not recover despite the best efforts of the British. The British made heroic efforts to try to save thousands of lives in Belsen, and they did. But I just want to point out that the paradox here is that they turned Belsen, which had been a concentration camp, into a large-scale settlement for these Jewish survivors. They opened up a hospital, they created soup kitchens and so forth. They did their best to offer health and welfare to these survivors, but they stayed in Belsen, and they had nowhere else to go. So they couldn't leave Germany to go to Palestine or to go to the United States, which is where many of them wanted to go. So they remained in the camp at Belsen for a number of years after the Second World War. That's not the story of liberation that we want to tell. We think of those camps as having been closed, destroyed, and wiped out. And in a general sense, of course, they were. But they were transformed into displaced persons camps for Jews who lived in them for many years after the war. It's a shocking story about the end of the Second World War and about liberation we don't talk about, I don't think, enough.
The other problem that the Allies had was exactly what to do with Germany, which was also somewhat debilitated after the war. They didn't want to be these overly harsh sort of conquering invaders, and so U.S. personnel in particular who moved into Germany to start doing post-war work found that they liked the Germans and that they had a lot in common with them. And meanwhile, the rest of Europe is looking and sees conditions in Germany being far better than they were in their own countries.
If there's one big paradox in the heart of this story, it's what the Americans make of Germany. The Germans are supposed to be the evil, horrible people. And as we know as historians, they were during the Second World War. And American soldiers were told by their commanders, look, we're going into Germany, these are the bad guys, they're Nazis, and they're going to deny it, but you have to hold them accountable, don't be nice to them, don't talk to them, don't ever shake hands with them, don't do any business with them, treat them like an occupied, defeated people. These were orders that came down from Eisenhower to the average GIs. They were going into Western Germany. Well, they got into Western Germany late fall, early spring, and then in a big way in March 1945. And what happened? Well, the American soldiers found the average German people they encountered in the small villages and the small little towns as they moved along through Western Germany to be basically sympathetic people. They were friendly, they were nice, they were clean, and that was a complaint they had about the French, who were not particularly clean, according to American soldiers. The Germans offered them goods. They didn't seem to be particularly crazy Nazis. They seemed to be fairly ordinary. So almost immediately, there was this kind of melting away of the reserve that they were supposed to feel. And Americans reached out to German civilians. And it's not the way it was planned. It wasn't supposed to be this way. And you can say, well, that's a good thing. That's a heartwarming story. But wait a minute. They were there to re-educate and instruct the Germans about the failings of what they had done during the Third Reich. And what actually happened was a fairly rapid reconciliation at the grassroots level between ordinary GIs and the German people. And, you know, that's a little controversial because we weren't able to instruct them quite as vigorously as we might have done if we'd maintained that cool distance they were supposed to maintain.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Griff in Fort Worth. Hi, Griff.
Hi. I have a question. I wondered if the Allied powers gave any consideration to creating a Jewish homeland out of part of Germany rather than taking the geographically correct but politically very difficult, as we have seen, expedient of putting Israel in the middle of the Arab world and all of the problems that that's created ever since the late 1940s, or alternatively, did they give any thought to trying to mainstream the displaced persons and concentration camp inmates back into German and Polish society? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, thanks, Griff. Well, they didn't really give much concentration to the idea of settling, creating a Jewish homeland in Germany, which would have been paradoxical indeed, given the way that the Germans had treated the Germans for such a long period of time. And after all, you have to remember, this is 1945. There is already a large-scale Jewish settlement. Settlement's really the wrong word, a Jewish presence in Palestine. And there's a long-running dispute at that time between the Jews in Palestine and the British, who had, at various stages in the first part of the 20th century, offered them the prospect of a national home in Palestine. So the Jewish communities in Europe felt very strongly that their destiny lay in Palestine, that they had a right to go there, and that the British were the problem. And as a matter of fact, the American government, Harry Truman, began to put a lot of pressure on the British, which was a Labor government at that time. Foreign Minister was Ernest Bevin. He put a lot of pressure on Bevin to start to change British policy. But that didn't happen until 1948, after which time a larger emigration was allowed to happen. But it was a very difficult problem that combined the grand strategy at the top, British and American relations at the very highest level, with a concern about who was going to be influential in the Middle East, where the British wanted to be in control, and the daily realities on the ground of Jews still living in displaced persons camps in Germany, an intolerable situation that was starting to get a lot of bad press for the United States.
Can you talk about what life was like within these camps? I mean, the people there were not necessarily being held against their will, but there wasn't much that they could do besides wait for a solution to open up.
That's right, and I mean it's actually kind of a wonderful story if you are willing to accept the cruel realities that these people are still in Germany. They managed to carve out an extraordinarily rich, albeit transient, life for themselves. They created newspapers, mostly in Yiddish. They created musical organizations, kindergartens, schools, a vocational school, so that when they finally did get to Palestine, they would have training in some particular technical skill. They tried to make out of these camps, which were perhaps had 15 to 20,000 people in them here and there, some kind of viable community relationship, some kind of viable existence, to make their time, time spent waiting, a little bit richer and a little bit more valuable for them. So it wasn't as if there was a sense of daily crisis. But the reality is this was a waiting game, and it seemed to them intolerable that they should still be held, as you say, not so much against their will, but without any alternatives, without freedom of choice to go where they really wanted to go. I mean, the fact that they couldn't go back to their homelands, imagine what that must have felt like. After having gone through the terrible crisis of the Holocaust itself, they then did not have the one right that everybody felt that they had earned in the Second World War, which was simply to go home, and they couldn't do that.
And in fact, there were other people who were refugees from the war that were displaced even farther than that. They were flown to Egypt in by the thousands to sort of wait out relief.
Yeah, well, there was a community of people from Yugoslavia who had been pushed out of Yugoslavia by the fighting there, who wound up in Egypt, in large-scale refugee camps in Egypt. One of the most interesting institutions that was created during the Second World War, again, one that we don't talk nearly enough about because it's not directly related to the combat, was a thing called the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, or UNRWA in short. And it wasn't a UN organization the way we think of UN organizations today, because the UN hadn't been created yet. But it was an international allied organization designed as a relief agency. And it set up the first displaced persons camps in Egypt outside of Cairo because the Allies controlled that territory. And it was able to look after tens of thousands of Yugoslavs, Italians, Greeks, and other people from southeastern Europe that settled in large camps there. So, I mean, one of the things that is just so breathtaking about the Second World War is what a jumble it is. How many millions of people from all different countries and walks of life find themselves living cheek by jowl in the most strangest of circumstances. Eventually, those people were repatriated through the work of UNRWA. They got them back to Yugoslavia. They got them back into Greece. But they spent years in tent cities in the deserts of Egypt at the tail end of the war.
Do you think that cultural mix sort of laid the foundation for Europe today as almost a sort of international single nation, you know, with the EU and the idea that, that European citizens have their own identity, but they also feel like they are friends or relatives with people from other countries within Europe?
Well, I wish that were so, but the Second World War was a time of very intense national conflict, and there's and not just national, but regional conflict. A country like Yugoslavia is a good example. During the Second World War, Yugoslavia not only fought a terrible German occupation, but Yugoslavs were fighting each other. As Croatians fought Serbs very, very bitterly. So I don't know how much the war, in the short term anyway, created a great sense of brotherhood. And after all, you have the Germans fighting the French and the Germans fighting everybody. On the other hand, I think that there's a longer term in which the common experience of the war, in which really everybody suffered, did create a set of memories to which Europeans could look back. And as the bitterness of the war faded, they could say, look, one thing we know is that we never want to fight each other again. That's something we never want to return to if we possibly can. And by and large, the Europeans have been enormously successful in settling their disputes, though I would point out that Yugoslavia is one important exception to this rule. As we remember, in the 1990s, the Yugoslavs began to fight one another once again. But generally speaking, yes, I think that the experiences of the war did serve as a powerful instructor to Europeans to say, we can never survive this kind of thing again. We have to find a better way to exist.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Will Hitchcock is my guest. The new book is called The Bitter Road to Freedom. Let's speak next to David in Plano. Hello, David.
Hi, Terry. I'm Chris, sorry.
That's okay.
I love it when authors, when people write history books because they are really good at showing us how decisions made 60, 70, 80 years ago can still affect us today, and this is a wonderful topic about that. My question for the guest, you kind of are one question, but I had a separate one having to do with the collective psyche of this part of the world, having gone through this kind of trauma and having experienced what they did. And we obviously know that, you know, after 1945, you had these two major powers basically right on the border of Europe. You had the Western powers, mainly U.S. and Britain, facing off against the communists in Russia and the Eastern Pact countries. How did that Cold War mentality, how did that play out for the countries? We know how America and Russia viewed each other. How did the European countries view the Cold War conflict that came out after World War II? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Oh, thanks, David. Well, that's actually a very good question. You know, what impact did the liberation of Europe have upon the way Europeans then experienced what came after the Cold War? And I just want to stress that, and this is something I try to stress in the book, for many Europeans, there was no liberation in 1945. And the reason for that is that the Soviet Union came crashing into Eastern Europe and did not really truly liberate Eastern Europe. I mean, they said they did, and they said they were an army of liberation. And for the entire Cold War period, they spoke of their great heroism, the Soviet heroism, in liberating Eastern Europe. But the truth of the matter is, as we know now, and we can say this long since demonstrated, the Russians came as occupiers also. So they pushed the German occupation out of Eastern Europe, but they transformed Eastern Europe into their own sphere of influence through a military and ideological occupation of that part of the world. They physically changed the borders of Poland and moved it westward. They physically occupied the eastern part of Germany and turned that into East Germany. They occupied and politicized Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Europe and turned it into a communist buffer zone, a communist bloc. So for a lot of Europeans in the East, They say, what liberation? When you talk about the liberation of Europe. And in a way, there's a, almost like a dialogue of the deaf with Americans who say, well, we liberated you people in 1945. And a lot of Eastern Europeans will say, well, not quite. I mean, in a way, we were never free until 1989, 1990. And in many ways, it's that liberation that a lot of Eastern Europeans look to perhaps even more fondly than the end of the Second World War, which is something we tend to forget, I think.
Well, and even among those who were liberated by the Allies and therefore left to sort of determine their own borders and control their own destinies, there was this really ambivalent mix of feelings. They were grateful that this had happened, but they were somewhat embarrassed that it had to happen, and they didn't quite know what to do with that.
Well, imagine. I mean, the United States and its allies had come into Europe, Western Europe, at the end of the Second World War as liberators, and it was the second time, really in one generation, that they'd done so. They'd come in 1917 and 1918 as well, and the idea that America had to save Europe not once but twice in a very short sort of 30-year period was a little bit embarrassing. But on a more human scale, imagine what it's like when a couple million heavily armed, very powerful foreigners show up on your doorstep and say, well, we're here as liberators, and then we plan to stay for a little while to make sure everything is running okay. The liberated peoples of France, of Belgium, of the Netherlands, even of Western Germany, though they weren't technically liberated, they looked at the Americans as helpful, as able, as basically humane. But when you live alongside soldiers for a long period of time, it's inevitable that bad things are going to happen. And we have a lot of evidence to show that, regrettably, there was a lot of looting by American and British and Canadian soldiers. There was sexual assault and violence that was visited upon various European people, and a lot of other problems that big armies carry with them into battle. And it's a regrettable story.
Even something that would seem mundane, where they would throw their trash when they were finished with things.
That's right. Well, the hungry of Holland looked at these well-supplied Americans and said, my goodness, you've got more food in your pack than we've seen in 3 months. So you can imagine the tension.
William I. Hitchcock is my guest. His new book is called The Bitter Road to Freedom, A New History of the Liberation of Europe. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can follow your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Temple University history professor William I. Hitchcock. His book is called The Bitter Road to Freedom, A New History of the Liberation of Europe. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. We should point out here, Will, as you do in the book, that these American soldiers, in many cases, were severely traumatized by what they had experienced previously in the war. And at this point, they had mixed feelings themselves about their role. They were proud of what they were working on, but they also just wanted to be home.
Well, one of the pleasures of doing a big research project like this is that I spent a lot of time reading the primary documents that have been created by many soldiers. They kept diaries. Sometimes they weren't supposed to, but they did anyway. They wrote letters. They wrote memoirs, sometimes unpublished, sometimes things they just kept in a drawer for a long time. And thank heavens, many of them have donated these materials to a variety of libraries in the United States, but also in Europe. There's an amazing collection in London at the Imperial War Museum of British soldiers' diaries and letters. Some of these, I kid you not, still have the dust of the Normandy fields stuck on the outside of them, and they're amazing windows into the minds and into the hearts of these young men who were trying to do their job, fight for the right, but who really didn't want to be there and who missed home and who were suffering themselves. And the consequence of battle, as we know now, but they didn't know then, is terribly debilitating for many soldiers who see things that they could never even imagine. And they see it not just once or twice, but dozens and then hundreds of times. And I was amazed at the honesty with which many soldiers wrote about their experiences. They tend almost never, in my experience, and these are, I've read a lot of this material, I've listened to a lot of oral histories, they tend never to trumpet their behavior, their actions as some kind of heroism. They are an enormously humble group of people who tend to deflect credit onto others and say we were there to do a job that we had to do and we didn't like it and we wanted to get the heck out of there, which may be one of the reasons they could be at times a little bit tough to the European civilians that they encountered.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now and speak with Linda. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I really appreciate this subject because I think it's something that's close to everyone's heart as Americans overseas. I, with my family, I lived in the Netherlands in the 1970s, and I had a chance to experience people over there in a very different way in how they looked at America, especially during the Nixon years. And one of the things that I got was a deep sense, not only of gratefulness, but a deep sense that they were liberated from a much worse humiliation and that the war represented, you know, the Germans, especially the occupation there. So, I mean, I guess I take issue with the fact that the American soldiers weren't really, you know, people weren't as grateful for them. And I'll take my comments, your comments up here. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Linda, you've really hit on a very important point, and it's really one of emphasis and interpretation. I don't by any means want to suggest that the Dutch or French or Belgians or Europeans in general are ungrateful. I think just the opposite. I think despite what we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years where we've talked a lot about anti-Americanism in Europe and so forth and differences over international affairs, I think that Europeans of particularly a certain generation over the age of maybe 50 or so are still enormously grateful to the United States for the liberation of Europe. I don't doubt that for a moment. I've had it confirmed again and again and again, so I agree with you that there is this profound sense of gratitude. After all, the Germans just were absolutely beastly and horrible beyond belief in their occupation policy. So Europeans were desperate to get the Germans out. The question is, what cost, what price did they pay as individuals, as families, as towns and cities, for their liberation? And the answer is the cost was very, very high. They gave thousands and thousands and thousands of civilian lives in the fight for freedom. My effort is not by any way to suggest that Europeans were ungrateful, but just to point out that they too paid a terrible price. In fact, what's amazing is how grateful they are, despite the terrible cost of the Second World War, to civilians all across the continent. And that's a really interesting story. How did Americans and Europeans become such good friends despite this horrible conflict that they went through?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Sabine in Blue Ridge. Hi, Sabine.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling just to reiterate your comments about how the Europeans, you know, were kind of victimized the second time when the Russians came and took over Eastern Europe. My family was from Germany. My grandmother told me stories of how her husband's family had a manufacturing plant, and when Hitler wanted to take it over for the war effort, the family refused, and her husband ended up in a concentration camp. My mother was born in 1941, so here was my grandmother by herself in the middle of war-torn Germany, an enemy of Hitler, because the family had, you know, refused to cooperate with him, and she has told me stories of how scared she was when she realized the Russians were coming, of carrying an infant in front of the Russian army through the Sudetenland back to Berlin to see if she could, you know, meet the Americans there and get protection from the Russians. And how after the war, the family's plant ended up in what became East Germany, and the family lost everything. And so, you know, it's hard for me to say and agree that, yes, the Germans were awful, and they did have some bad policies, and I fully believe, you know, the Holocaust was the most horrible thing ever. But my family, true Germans, also suffered because of their personal beliefs and then the Russians coming in and taking over East Germany. So for me, as being the first, I came over in 1972 when I was 8 years old because my German mother married an American serviceman. So, you know, there you go. You combine the German and the American again. And it's just, but it's hard for me to really say, okay, yes, it was all awful because our family suffered as well.
Sabine, thank you so much for your call. I think it points to the fact that, war really is awful for everyone involved.
Well, but Sabine really hits on a very important topic, and it's one that has twisted up a lot of people into knots in Europe and in America as well. And the question is this: were the German people who suffered at the hands of the Russians, and millions did, were they also victims? Now, you might at first say, well, of course they were. But wait a minute. The Germans were the ones who started this whole thing. So can they be both victimizers and victims? Should we treat them as both the enemy and as the poor victims as well? And the truth is there's no really good answer. And Sabine is getting at this very issue. As far as millions of Eastern Germans were concerned, what the Russians did to them, they kicked them out of their homes, they seized their property. There was a terrible amount of sexual assault by Red Army troops on people in Eastern Germany. And they eradicated East Prussia, which was a part of Germany. They took it over and split it up and gave much of it to Poland. That was a kind of victimization that was, in German eyes, just as bad as what Nazis had done to other people. Now, we can decide whether or not we accept that argument, but many Germans after the Second World War said, hey, we suffered too, so don't lecture us about how bad it was for everybody else, because we too paid a price. Well, you can imagine that there are certain communities that don't accept that argument, that say, no. Germany, you still have never fully paid back for the horrible things that you've done. But there were many people who during the Cold War in Germany said, you know, the Russians are really the bad guys. Hitler was bad, but the Russians were much worse. Well, these are difficult questions to get at historically, because people have invested them with so much personal emotion, depending on their personal family circumstances.
Will, you brought this question up before, and I didn't really give you a chance to answer it for yourself and for all of us, but why is it that you think that the Americans and the Europeans have been able to very quickly forge this extremely strong bond and really hang on to it since the war?
Well, I think that there are a number of reasons. The first reason that despite the terrible damage that Americans and British inflicted on particularly in Western Europe, the Europeans and Americans quickly became friends after the war. First of all, the first reason is total victory. The Allied armies completely and totally, utterly defeated Nazism and its ideology. So there was no way for a lingering sentiment, resentment, a sort of a return of the bad guys ever to really take place. There was total victory, and that meant that the cause was fully legitimated. The second thing I think that Americans did that was very wise was in the liberated countries of Western Europe, they very, very quickly gave political power back to the liberated peoples. They didn't occupy France militarily. They didn't occupy Belgium militarily or the Netherlands. They only occupied enemy countries. And then even there, Germany and Italy, they turned over political power very quickly. So they got out of the way. They came, they defeated the bad guys, and then they got out of the way. And the third reason that I think is very important is the amazing humanitarian effort that Americans spearheaded right after the war. And I don't even mean the Marshall Plan, which came in 1948, but the amazing sacrifices that thousands of Americans, humanitarian relief workers, gave to Europe. They packed bags and boxes, and they gave medicine and food and clothing. Thousands of people on the home front mobilized on behalf of European people and helped them out in their hour of need. And this was never forgotten. An earlier caller who talked about the Netherlands, especially in the Netherlands, they still talk about the Red Cross packages that they got from the British and from the Canadians and the Americans with a sense of real joy and gratitude. So these early gestures were critical in building that bridge of friendship.
Let's take one more quick call from Rudy in Dallas. Hi, Rudy.
Hello there.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I just wonder if you were familiar with the atrocities that happened to the Germans in 1944, starting October 1st when the Russians came in. As you probably know, Yugoslavia was created and put together, so to speak, after World War One. There were some quarter million Germans living there that ended up in Marshal Tito's concentration camps.
Yes, regrettably, there was a great deal of ethnic cleansing going on in southeastern Europe, and there was a lot of transfer of populations in the tail end of the war. Is that what you're particularly thinking of?
Yes, I was there till age 14. We have left October 1, 1944, to go to Germany, as the Germans withdrew of German descent. You had not much of a choice but to flee from the Russians.
And where did you spend much of the where did you spend all that time? Do you remember what town or?
Close to Lichtenfels in southern Germany until 1952, when I immigrated to the U.S. And as far as any hatred against Americans in Germany, there was no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
If it wouldn't have been for the Americans, we wouldn't have survived.
Rudy, thanks very much for your call.
Okay.
I think Rudy's story is like so many that that you can hear of the way in which individual lives were totally upended and completely, I won't say destroyed, but completely changed by the clashing of armies across Eastern Europe and Southern Europe and Central Europe. All of these communities, national communities, ethnic groups, were mixed together. They were manhandled by the great powers. They were pushed against their will in all different directions. And trying to sort this out has been an incredible challenge, both for the armies that were there at the time, but also for historians as we look at this sort of leopard skin of ethnicities and nationalities in Europe and see how much they suffered themselves during the war at the hands of the liberators.
So, Will, obviously it would be irresponsible to draw exact parallels, but I'm wondering if you can think of some lessons from the Second World War at its end that we might be able to apply to our efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan to ease the suffering of people there who at some point will be freed from having active conflict all around them.
Well, I think the first lesson is not so much about Iraq and Afghanistan, but is about ourselves. And that is, let's not make a myth out of the Second World War. We're very comfortable, I think, in a certain kind of story about the Second World War, in which we tend to think of it as the good war. And, of course, it was the good war. And I'm using the title of Studs Terkel's book. He recently passed, and he left us that kind of ironic term. But we must not just talk about American greatness, because if we do that, we lose sight of the human costs as well. I think we can manage a history that balances out the great American sacrifices with the realities that liberation on the ground is going to be a very brutal business, and that although in the long run you're fighting a just war and you believe in the cause, in the long run you're still going to cause a lot of suffering for average people, and they're going to be conflicted. On the one hand, they'll be happy that you've saved them from one tyranny, but you have to make sure you're prepared to offer them the realities of freedom right away. And that's what I think Americans did in this end of the Second World War in Europe. I don't think it's been as successful in other cases since then.
William I. Hitchcock is professor of history at Temple University. His new book is called The Bitter Road to Freedom, A New History of the Liberation of Europe. Will, really interesting information. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks an awful lot, Chris. I really appreciated the conversation.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.